Fear is AU 1, 2, and 4, or more fully, 1, 2, 4, 5, and 20, with or without action units 25, 26, or 27. That is, the inner brow raiser, frontalis pars medialis, plus the outer brow raiser, frontalis pars lateralis, plus the brow-lowering depressor supercili, plus the levator palpebri superioris, which raises the upper lid, plus the risorius, which stretches the lips, plus the parting of the lips, depressor labii, plus the masseter, which drops the jaw. Discussed? That's mostly AU9, the wrinkling of the nose, levator labii superioris saliqui nasi, but it can sometimes be 10, and in either case, it may be combined with AU15 or 16 or 17. Ekman and Friesen ultimately assembled all these combinations and the rules for reading and interpreting them into the Facial Action Coding System, or FACS, and wrote them up in a 500-page document. It is a strangely riveting work, full of such details as the possible movements of the lips, elongate, de-elongate, narrow, widen, flatten, protrude, tighten, and stretch, the four different changes of the skin between the eyes and the cheeks, bulges, bags, pouches, and lines, and the critical distinctions between infraorbital furrows and the nasolabial furrow. John Gottman, whose research on marriage I wrote about in Chapter 1, has collaborated with Ekman for years and uses the principles of FACS in analyzing the emotional states of couples. Other researchers have employed Ekman's system to study everything from schizophrenia to heart disease. It has even been put to use by computer animators at Pixar, Toy Story, and DreamWorks, Shrek. FACS takes weeks to master in its entirety, and only 500 people around the world have been certified to use it in research. But those who have mastered it gain an extraordinary level of insight into the messages we send each other when we look into one another's eyes. Ekman recalled the first time he saw Bill Clinton during the 1992 Democratic primaries. "I was watching his facial expressions, and I said to my wife, 'This is Peck's bad boy,'" Ekman said. "This is a guy who wants to be caught with his hand in the cookie jar and have us love him for it anyway. There was this expression that's one of his favorites. It's that hand in the cookie jar, 'Love me, mommy, because I'm a rascal,' look. It's AU 12, 15, 17, and 24 with an eye roll." Ekman paused, then reconstructed that particular sequence of expressions on his face. He contracted his zygomatic major, AU 12, in a classic smile, then tugged the corners of his lips down with his triangularis, AU 15. He flexed the mentalis, AU 17, which raises the chin, slightly pressed his lips together in AU 24, and finally rolled his eyes, and it was as if Slick Willie himself were suddenly in the room. "I knew someone who was on Clinton's communication staff, so I contacted him. I said, 'Look, Clinton's got this way of rolling his eyes along with a certain expression, and what it conveys is, I'm a bad boy. I don't think it's a good thing. I could teach him how not to do that in 2 or 3 hours.' And he said, 'Well, we can't take the risk that he's known to be seeing an expert on lying.'" Ekman's voice trailed off. It was clear that he rather liked Clinton, and that he wanted Clinton's expression to have been no more than a meaningless facial tick. Ekman shrugged. Unfortunately, I guess, he needed to get caught, and he got caught. Section 3. The Naked Face. What Ekman is saying is that the face is an enormously rich source of information about emotion. In fact, he makes an even bolder claim, one central to understanding how mind reading works, and that is that the information on our face is not just a signal of what is going on inside our mind. In a certain sense, it is what is going on inside our minds. The beginnings of this insight came when Ekman and Friesen were first sitting across from each other, working on expressions of anger and distress. It was weeks before one of us finally admitted feeling terrible after a session where we'd been making one of those faces all day, Friesen says. Then the other realized that he'd been feeling poorly too, so we began to keep track. They then went back and began monitoring their bodies during particular facial movements. Say you do AU1, raising the inner eyebrows, and 6, raising the cheeks, and 15, the lowering of the corner of the lips, Ekman said, and then did all 3. What we discovered is that that expression alone is sufficient to create marked changes in the autonomic nervous system. When this first occurred, we were stunned. We weren't expecting this at all. And it happened to both of us. We felt terrible. What we were generating were sadness, anguish. And when I lower my brows, which is 4, and raise the upper eyelid, which is 5, and narrow the eyelids, which is 7, and press the lips together, which is 24, I'm generating anger. My heartbeat will go up 10 to 12 beats. My hands will get hot. And as I do it, I can't disconnect from the system. It's very unpleasant, very unpleasant. Ekman, Friesen, and another colleague, Robert Levinson, who has also collaborated for years with John Gottman, Psychology is a Small World, decided to try to document this effect. They gathered a group of volunteers and hooked them up to monitors measuring their heart rate and body temperature, the physiological signals of such emotions as anger, sadness, and fear. Half of the volunteers were told to try to remember and relive a particularly stressful experience. The other half were simply shown how to create on their faces the expressions that corresponded to stressful emotions, such as anger, sadness, and fear. The second group, the people who were acting, showed the same physiological responses, the same heightened heart rate and body temperature as the first group. A few years later, a German team of psychologists conducted a similar study. They had a group of subjects look at cartoons, either while holding a pen between their lips, an action that made it impossible to contract either of the 2 major smiling muscles, the risorius and the zygomatic major, or while holding a pen clenched between their teeth, which had the opposite effect and forced them to smile. The people with the pen between their teeth found the cartoons much funnier. These findings may be hard to believe because we take it as a given that first we experience an emotion, and then we may, or may not, express that emotion on our face. We think of the face as the residue of emotion. What this research showed, though, is that the process works in the opposite direction as well. Emotion can also start on the face. The face is not a secondary billboard for our internal feelings. It is an equal partner in the emotional process. This critical point has enormous implications for the act of mind reading. Early in his career, for example, Paul Ekman filmed 40 psychiatric patients, including a woman named Mary, a 42-year-old housewife. She had attempted suicide 3 times, and she survived the last attempt, an overdose of pills, only because someone found her in time and rushed her to the hospital. Her grown children had left home, and her husband was inattentive, and she was depressed. When she first went to the hospital, she did nothing but sit and cry, but she seemed to respond well to therapy. After 3 weeks, she told her doctor that she was feeling much better and she wanted a weekend pass to see her family. The doctor agreed, but just before Mary was to leave the hospital, she confessed that the real reason she wanted a weekend pass was to make another suicide attempt. Several years later, when a group of young psychiatrists asked Ekman how they could tell when suicidal patients were lying, he remembered the film Taken of Mary and decided to see if it held the answer. If the face really was a reliable guide to emotion, he reasoned, shouldn't he be able to look back at the film and see that Mary was lying when she said she was feeling better? Ekman and Friesen began to analyze the film for clues. They played it over and over for dozens of hours, examining in slow motion every gesture and expression. Finally, they saw what they were looking for. When Mary's doctor asked her about her plans for the future A look of utter despair flashed across her face so quickly that it was almost imperceptible. Ekman calls that kind of fleeting look a micro-expression, which is a very particular and critical kind of facial expression. Many facial expressions can be made voluntarily. If I'm trying to look stern as I give you a tongue lashing, I'll have no difficulty doing so, and you'll have no difficulty interpreting my glare. But our faces are also governed by a separate, involuntary system that makes expressions that we have no conscious control over. Few of us, for instance, can voluntarily do AU1, the sadness sign. A notable exception, Ekman points out, is Woody Allen, who uses his frontalis, pars medialis, to create his trademark look of comic distress. Yet we raise our inner eyebrows without thinking when we are unhappy. Watch a baby just as he or she starts to cry, and you'll often see the frontalis, pars medialis, shoot up as if it were on a string. Similarly, there is an expression that Ekman has dubbed the Duchenne smile, in honor of the 19th-century French neurologist Guillaume Duchenne, who first attempted to document with a camera the workings of the muscles of the face. If I were to ask you to smile, you would flex your zygomatic major. By contrast, if you were to smile spontaneously, in the presence of genuine emotion, you would not only flex your zygomatic, but also tighten the orbicularis oculi pars orbitalis, which is the muscle that encircles the eye. It is almost impossible to tighten the orbicularis oculi pars orbitalis on demand, and it is equally difficult to stop it from tightening when we smile at something genuinely pleasurable. This kind of smile does not obey the will, Duchenne wrote. Its absence unmasks the false friend. Whenever we experience a basic emotion, that emotion is automatically expressed by the muscles of the face. That response may linger on the face for just a fraction of a second, or be detectable only if electronic sensors are attached to the face. But it's always there. Sylvan Tompkins once began a lecture by bellowing, "The face is like the penis." What he meant was that the face has, to a large extent, a mind of its own. This doesn't mean we have no control over our faces. We can use our voluntary muscular system to try to suppress those involuntary responses. But often, some little part of that suppressed emotion, such as the sense that I'm really unhappy, even if I deny it, leaks out. That's what happened to Mary. Our voluntary expressive system is the way we intentionally signal our emotions. But our involuntary expressive system is in many ways even more important. It is the way we have been equipped by evolution to signal our authentic feelings. You must have had the experience where somebody comments on your expression and you didn't know you were making it, Ekman says. Somebody asks you, "What are you getting upset about?" Or, "Why are you smirking?" You can hear your voice, but you can't see your face. If we knew what was on our face, we would be better at concealing it, but that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing. Imagine if there were a switch that all of us had to turn off the expressions on our face at will. If babies had that switch, we wouldn't know what they were feeling. They'd be in trouble. You could make an argument, if you wanted to, that the system evolved so that parents would be able to take care of kids. Or imagine if you were married to someone with a switch. It would be impossible. I don't think mating and infatuation and friendships and closeness would occur if our faces didn't work that way. Ekman slipped a tape from the O.J. Simpson trial into the VCR. It showed Cato Kalin, Simpson's shaggy-haired houseguest, being questioned by Marcia Clark, the lead prosecutor in the case. Kalin sits in the witness box with a vacant look on his face. Clark asks a hostile question. Kalin leans forward and answers her softly. "Did you see that?" Ekman asked me. "I saw nothing, just Cato being Cato, harmless and passive." Ekman stopped the tape, rewound it, and played it back in slow motion. On the screen, Kalin moved forward to answer the question, and in that fraction of a second, his face was utterly transformed. His nose wrinkled, as he flexed his levator labii superioris aliqui nasi. His teeth were bared, his brows lowered. It was almost totally AU9, Ekman said. It's disgust, with anger there as well, and the clue to that is that when your eyebrows go down, typically your eyes are not as open as they are here. The raised upper eyelid is a component of anger, not disgust. It's very quick. Ekman stopped the tape and played it again, peering at the screen. You know, he looks like a snarling dog. Ekman showed another clip, this one from a press conference given by Harold Kim Philby in 1955. Philby had not yet been revealed as a Soviet spy, but two of his colleagues, Donald MacLean and Guy Burgess, had just defected to the Soviet Union. Philby is wearing a dark suit and a white shirt. His hair is straight and parted on the left. His face has the hauteur of privilege. Mr. Philby, a reporter asks, Mr. MacMillan, the foreign secretary, said there was no evidence that you were the so-called third man who allegedly tipped off Burgess and MacLean. Are you satisfied with that clearance that he gave you? Philby answers confidently, in the plummy tones of the English upper class. Yes, I am. Well, if there was a third man, were you in fact the third man? No, Philby says, just as forcefully. I was not. Ekman rewound the tape and replayed it in slow motion. Look at this, he said, pointing to the screen. Twice, after being asked serious questions about whether he's committed treason, he's going to smirk. He looks like the cat who ate the canary. The expression came and went in no more than a few milliseconds. But at quarter speed, it was painted on his face, the lips pressed together in a look of pure smugness. He's enjoying himself, isn't he? Ekman went on. I call this duping delight, the thrill you get from fooling other people. Ekman started up the VCR again. There's another thing he does, he said. On the screen, Philby is answering another question. In the second place, the Burgess-MacLean affair has raised issues of great, he pauses, delicacy. Ekman went back to the pause and froze the tape. Here it is, he said, a very subtle micro-expression of distress or unhappiness. It's only in the eyebrows, in fact, just in one eyebrow. Sure enough, Philby's right inner eyebrow was raised in an unmistakable AU1. It's very brief, Ekman said. He's not doing it voluntarily, and it totally contradicts all his confidence and assertiveness. It comes when he's talking about Burgess and MacLean, whom he had tipped off. It's a hot spot that suggests you shouldn't trust what you hear. What Ekman is describing, in a very real sense, is the physiological basis of how we thin-slice other people. We can all mind-read effortlessly and automatically because the clues we need to make sense of someone or some social situation are right there on the faces of those in front of us. We may not be able to read faces as brilliantly as someone like Paul Ekman or Sylvan Tompkins can, or pick up moments as subtle as Cato Kalin's transformation into a snarling dog. But there is enough accessible information on a face to make everyday mind reading possible. When someone tells us, I love you, we look immediately and directly at him or her because by looking at the face we can know, or at least we can know a great deal more, about whether the sentiment is genuine. Do we see tenderness and pleasure? Or do we catch a fleeting micro-expression of distress and unhappiness flickering across his or her face? A baby looks into your eyes when you cup your hands over hers because she knows she can find an explanation in your face. Are you contracting action units 6 and 12, the orbicularis oculi, pars orbitalis, in combination with the zygomatic major, in a sign of happiness? Or are you contracting action units 1, 2, 4, 5, and 20, the frontalis pars medialis, the frontalis pars lateralis, the depressor supercilii, the levator palpebri superioris, and the risorius, in what even a child intuitively understands as the clear signal of fear. We make these kinds of complicated, lightning-fast calculations very well. We make them every day, and we make them without thinking. And this is the puzzle of the Amadou Diallo case. Because in the early hours of February 4, 1999, Sean Carroll and his fellow officers, for some reason, could not do this at all. Diallo was innocent, curious, and terrified, and every one of those emotions must have been written all over his face. Yet they saw none of it. Why? Section 4. A man, a woman, and a light switch. The classic model for understanding what it means to lose the ability to mind read is the condition of autism. When someone is autistic, he or she is, in the words of the British psychologist Simon Baron Cohen, mind blind. People with autism find it difficult, if not impossible, to do all of the things that I've been describing so far as natural and automatic human processes. They have difficulty interpreting nonverbal cues, such as gestures and facial expressions, or putting themselves inside someone else's head, or drawing understanding from anything other than the literal meaning of words. Their first impression apparatus is fundamentally disabled, and the way that people with autism see the world gives us a very good sense of what happens when our mind-reading faculties fail. One of the country's leading experts on autism is a man named Ami Klein. Klein teaches at Yale University's Child Study Center in New Haven, where he has a patient whom he's been studying for many years, whom I'll call Peter. Peter is in his 40s. He is highly educated and works and lives independently. This is a very high-functioning individual. We meet weekly and we talk, Klein explains. He's very articulate, but he has no intuition about things. So he needs me to define the world for him. Klein, who bears a striking resemblance to the actor Martin Short, is half Israeli and half Brazilian, and he speaks with an understandably peculiar accent. He has been seeing Peter for years, and he speaks of his condition not with condescension or detachment, but matter-of-factly, as if describing a minor character tic. I talk to him every week, and the sense that I have in talking to him is that I could do anything. I could pick my nose. I could take my pants down. I could do some work here. Even though he's looking at me, I don't have the sense of being scrutinized or monitored. He focuses very much on what I say. The words mean a great deal to him, but he doesn't focus at all on the way my words are contextualized with facial expressions and nonverbal cues. Everything that goes on inside the mind, that he cannot observe directly, is a problem for him. Am I his therapist? Not really. Normal therapy is based on people's ability to have insight into their own motivations. But with him, insight wouldn't take you very far. So it's more like problem solving. One of the things that Klein wanted to discover in talking to Peter was how someone with his condition makes sense of the world. So he and his colleagues devised an ingenious experiment. They decided to show Peter a movie and then follow the direction of his eyes as he looked at the screen. The movie they chose was the 1966 film version of the Edward Albee play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor as a husband and wife who invite a much younger couple, played by George Segal and Sandy Dennis, for what turns out to be an intense and grueling evening. It's my favorite play ever, and I love the movie. I love Richard Burton. I love Elizabeth Taylor, Klein explains. And for what Klein was trying to do, the film was perfect. People with autism are obsessed with mechanical objects, but this was a movie that followed very much the spare, actor-focused design of the stage. It's tremendously contained, Klein says. It's about four people and their minds. There are very few inanimate details in that movie that would be distracting to someone with autism, If I had used Terminator 2, where the protagonist is a gun, I wouldn't have got these results. It's all about intensive, engaging social interaction at multiple levels of meaning, emotion, and expression. What we are trying to get at is people's search for meaning. So that's why I chose Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I was interested in getting to see the world through the eyes of an autistic person. Klein had Peter put on a hat with a very simple but powerful eye-tracking device composed of two tiny cameras. One camera recorded the movement of Peter's fovea, the centerpiece of his eye. The other camera recorded whatever it was Peter was looking at, and then the two images were superimposed. This meant that on every frame of the movie, Klein could draw a line showing where Peter was looking at that moment. He then had people without autism watch the movie as well, and he compared Peter's eye movements with theirs. In one scene, for example, Nick, George Siegel, is making polite conversation, and he points to the wall of host George's, Richard Burton's, study, and asks, "Who did the painting?" The way you and I would look at that scene is straightforward. Our eyes would follow in the direction that Nick is pointing, alight on the painting, swivel back to George's eyes to get his response, and then return to Nick's face to see how he reacts to the answer. All of that takes place in a fraction of a second, and on Klein's visual scanning pictures, the line representing the gaze of the normal viewer forms a clean, straight-edged triangle from Nick to the painting to George and then back again to Nick. Peter's pattern, though, is a little different. He starts somewhere around Nick's neck, but he doesn't follow the direction of Nick's arm because interpreting a pointing gesture requires, if you think about it, that you instantaneously inhabit the mind of the person doing the pointing. You need to read the mind of the pointer, and of course, people with autism can't read minds. Children respond to pointing gestures by the time they are 12 months old, Klein said. This is a man who is 42 years old and very bright, and he's not doing that. Those are the kind of cues that children are learning naturally, and he just doesn't pick up on them. So what does Peter do? He hears the words painting and wall, so he looks for paintings on the wall. But there are three in the general vicinity. Which one is it? Klein's visual scanning pictures show Peter's gaze moving frantically from one picture to the other. Meanwhile, the conversation has already moved on. The only way Peter could have made sense of that scene is if Nick had been perfectly verbally explicit. If he had said, "Who did that painting to the left of the man and the dog?" In anything less than a perfectly literal environment, the autistic person is lost. There's another critical lesson in that scene. The normal viewers looked at the eyes of George and Nick when they were talking, and they did that because when people talk, we listen to their words and watch their eyes in order to pick up on all those expressive nuances that Ekman has so carefully cataloged. But Peter didn't look at anyone's eyes in that scene. At another critical moment in the movie, when in fact George and Martha, Elizabeth Taylor, are locked in a passionate embrace, Peter looked not at the eyes of the kissing couple, which is what you or I would do, but at the light switch on the wall behind them. That's not because Peter objects to people or finds the notion of intimacy repulsive. It's because if you cannot mind read, if you can't put yourself in the mind of someone else, then there's nothing special to be gained by looking at eyes and faces. One of Klein's colleagues at Yale, Robert T. Schultz, once did an experiment with what is called an fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imagery, a highly sophisticated brain scanner that shows where the blood is flowing in the brain at any given time, and hence which part of the brain is in use. Schultz put people in the fMRI machine and had them perform a very simple task in which they were given either pairs of faces or pairs of objects, such as chairs or hammers, and they had to press a button indicating whether the pairs were the same or different. Normal people, when they were looking at the faces, used a part of their brain called the fusiform gyrus, which is an incredibly sophisticated piece of brain software that allows us to distinguish among the literally thousands of faces that we know. Picture in your mind the face of Marilyn Monroe. You just used your fusiform gyrus. When the normal participants looked at the chair, however, they used a completely different and less powerful part of the brain, the inferior temporal gyrus, which is normally reserved for objects. The difference in the sophistication of those two regions explains why you can recognize Sally from the eighth grade 40 years later, but have trouble picking out your bag on the airport luggage carousel. When Schultz repeated the experiment with autistic people, however, he found that they used their object recognition area for both the chairs and the faces. In other words, on the most basic neurological level, for someone with autism, a face is just another object. Here is one of the earliest descriptions of an autistic patient in the medical literature. He never looked up at people's faces. When he had any dealings with persons at all, he treated them, or rather parts of them, as if they were objects. He would use a hand to lead him. He would, in playing, butt his head against his mother, as at other times he did against a pillow. He allowed his boarding mother's hand to dress him, paying not the slightest attention to her. So, when Peter looked at the scene of Martha and George kissing, their two faces did not automatically command his attention. What he saw were three objects, a man, a woman, and a light switch. And what did he prefer? As it happens, the light switch. I know, for Peter, that light switches have been important in his life, says Klein. He sees a light switch, and he gravitates toward it. It's like if you were a Matisse connoisseur, and you look at a lot of pictures, and then you'd go, ah, there is the Matisse. So he goes, there is a light switch. He's seeking meaning, organization. He doesn't like confusion. All of us gravitate toward things that mean something to us. And for most of us, that's people. But if people don't anchor meaning for you, then you seek something that does. Perhaps the most poignant scene Klein studied comes at a point in the movie when Martha is sitting next to Nick, flirting outrageously, even putting a hand on his thigh. In the background, his back slightly turned to them, lurks an increasingly angry and jealous George. As the scene unfolds, the normal viewer's eyes move in an almost perfect triangle, from Martha's eyes to Nick's eyes to George's eyes, and then back to Martha's, monitoring the emotional states of all three as the temperature in the room rises. But Peter? He starts at Nick's mouth, and then his eyes drop to the drink in Nick's hand, and then his gaze wanders to a brooch on Martha's sweater. He never looks at George at all, so the entire emotional meaning of the scene is lost on him. There's a scene where George is about to lose his temper, says Warren Jones, who worked with Klein on the experiment. He goes to the closet and pulls a gun down from the shelf and points it directly at Martha and pulls the trigger. And when he does, an umbrella pops out of the front of the barrel. But we have no idea until it comes out that it's a ruse, so there is this genuine moment of fear. And one of the most telltale things is that the classic autistic individual will laugh out loud and find it to be this moment of real physical comedy. They've missed the emotional basis for the act. They read only the superficial aspect that he pulls the trigger, an umbrella pops out, and they walk away thinking, those people were having a good time. Peter's movie-watching experiment is a perfect example of what happens when mind-reading fails. Peter is a highly intelligent man. He has a graduate degree from a prestigious university. His IQ is well above normal, and Klein speaks of him with genuine respect. But because he lacks one very basic ability, the ability to mind-read, he can be presented with that scene in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and come to a conclusion that is socially completely and catastrophically wrong. Peter, understandably, makes this kind of mistake often. He has a condition that makes him permanently mind blind. But I can't help but wonder if, under certain circumstances, the rest of us could momentarily think like Peter as well. What if it were possible for autism, for mind blindness, to be a temporary condition instead of a chronic one? Could that explain why sometimes otherwise normal people come to conclusions that are completely and catastrophically wrong? Section 5. Arguing with a Dog. In the movies and in detective shows on television, people fire guns all the time. They shoot and shoot and run after people, and sometimes they kill them, and when they do, they stand over the body and smoke a cigarette and then go and have a beer with their partner. To hear Hollywood tell it, shooting a gun is a fairly common and straightforward act. The truth is, though, that it isn't. Most police officers, well over 90%, go their whole career without ever firing at anyone, and those who do describe the experience as so unimaginably stressful that it seems reasonable to ask if firing a gun could be the kind of experience that could cause temporary autism. Here, for example, are excerpts of interviews that the University of Missouri criminologist David Klinger did with police officers for his fascinating book, Into the Kill Zone. The first is with an officer who fired on a man who was threatening to kill his partner, Dan. He looked up, saw me, and said, "Oh, shit." Not like, "Oh, shit, I'm scared," but like, "Oh, shit, now here's somebody else I gotta kill." Real, aggressive, and mean. Instead of continuing to push the gun at Dan's head, he started to try to bring it around on me. This all happened real fast, in milliseconds. And at the same time, I was bringing my gun up. Dan was still fighting with him, and the only thought that came through my mind was, "Oh, dear God, don't let me hit Dan." I fired 5 rounds. My vision changed as soon as I started to shoot. It went from seeing the whole picture to just the suspect's head. Everything else just disappeared. I didn't see Dan anymore. Didn't see anything else. All I could see was the suspect's head. I saw 4 of my 5 rounds hit. The first one hit him on his left eyebrow. It opened up a hole, and the guy's head snapped back, and he said, "Ooh," like, "Ooh, you got me." He still continued to turn the gun toward me, and I fired my 2nd round. I saw a red dot right below the base of his left eye, and his head kind of turned sideways. I fired 1 round. It hit on the outside of his left eye, and his eye exploded, just ruptured and came out. My 4th round hit just in front of his left ear. The 3rd round had moved his head even further sideways to me, and when the 4th round hit, I saw a red dot open on the side of his head, then close up. I didn't see where my last round went. Then I heard the guy fall backwards and hit the ground. Here's another. When he started towards us, it was almost like it was in slow motion, and everything went into a tight focus. When he made his move, my whole body just tensed up. I don't remember having any feeling from my chest down. Everything was focused forward to watch and react to my target. Talk about an adrenaline rush. Everything tightened up, and all my senses were directed forward at the man running at us with a gun. My vision was focused on his torso and the gun. I couldn't tell you what his left hand was doing. I have no idea. I was watching the gun. The gun was coming down in front of his chest area, and that's when I did my 1st shots. I didn't hear a thing, not one thing. Alan had fired one round when I shot my first pair, but I didn't hear him shoot. He shot two more rounds when I fired the second time, but I didn't hear any of those rounds either. We stopped shooting when he hit the floor and slid into me. Then I was on my feet standing over the guy. I don't even remember pushing myself up. All I know is the next thing I knew, I was standing on 2 feet, looking down at the guy. I don't know how I got there, whether I pushed up with my hands or whether I pulled my knees up underneath. I don't know, but once I was up, I was hearing things again because I could hear brass still clinking on the tile floor. Time had also returned to normal by then because it had slowed down during the shooting. That started as soon as he started towards us. Even though I knew he was running at us, it looked like he was moving in slow motion. Damnedest thing I ever saw. I think you'll agree that these are profoundly strange stories. In the first instance, the officer appears to be describing something that is quite impossible. How can someone watch his bullets hit someone? Just as strange is the second man's claim not to have heard the sound of his gun going off. How can that be? Yet, in interviews with police officers who have been involved with shootings, these same details appear again and again. Extreme visual clarity, tunnel vision, diminished sound, and the sense that time is slowing down. This is how the human body reacts to extreme stress, and it makes sense. Our mind, faced with a life-threatening situation, drastically limits the range and amount of information that we have to deal with. Sound and memory and broader social understanding are sacrificed in favor of heightened awareness of the threat directly in front of us. In a critical sense, the police officers whom Klinger describes perform better because their sense is narrowed. That narrowing allowed them to focus on the threat in front of them. But what happens when this stress response is taken to an extreme? Dave Grossman, a former Army lieutenant colonel and the author of On Killing, argues that the optimal state of arousal, the range in which stress improves performance, is when our heart rate is between 115 and 145 beats per minute. Grossman says that when he measured the heart rate of champion marksman Ron Avery, Avery's pulse was at the top of that range when he was performing in the field. The basketball superstar Larry Bird used to say that at critical moments in the game, the court would go quiet and the players would seem to be moving in slow motion. He clearly played basketball in that same optimal range of arousal in which Ron Avery performed. But very few basketball players see the court as clearly as Larry Bird did, and that's because very few people play in that optimal range. Most of us, under pressure, get too aroused, and past a certain point, our bodies begin shutting down so many sources of information that we start to become useless. After 145, Grossman says, bad things begin to happen. Complex motor skills start to break down. Doing something with one hand and not the other becomes very difficult. At 175, we begin to see an absolute breakdown of cognitive processing. The forebrain shuts down, and the midbrain, the part of your brain that's the same as your dog's, all mammals have that part of the brain, reaches up and hijacks the forebrain. Have you ever tried to have a discussion with an angry or frightened human being? You can't do it. You might as well try to argue with your dog. Vision becomes even more restricted. Behavior becomes inappropriately aggressive. In an extraordinary number of cases, people who are fired upon void their bowels because at the heightened level of threat represented by a heart rate of 175 and above, the body considers that kind of physiological control a non-essential activity. Blood is withdrawn from our outer muscle layer and concentrated in core muscle mass. The evolutionary point of that is to make the muscles as hard as possible, to turn them into a kind of armor and limit bleeding in the event of injury. But that leaves us clumsy and helpless. Grossman says that everyone should practice dialing 911 for this very reason, because he has heard of too many situations where, in an emergency, people pick up the phone and cannot perform this most basic of function. With their heart rate soaring and their motor coordination deteriorating, they dial 411 and not 911 because that's the only number they remember. Or they forget to press send on their cell phone. Or they simply cannot pick out the individual numbers at all. You must rehearse it, Grossman says, because only if you have rehearsed it will it be there. This is precisely the reason that many police departments in recent years have banned high-speed chases. It's not just because of the dangers of hitting some innocent bystander during the chase, although that is clearly part of the worry, since about 300 Americans are killed accidentally every year during chases. It's also because of what happens after the chase, since pursuing a suspect at high speed is precisely the kind of activity that pushes police officers into this dangerous state of high arousal. The LA riot was started by what cops did to Rodney King at the end of the high-speed chase, says James Fife, head of training for the NYPD, who has testified in many police brutality cases. The Liberty City riot in Miami in 1980 was started by what cops did at the end of a chase. They beat a guy to death. In 1986, they had another riot in Miami based on what cops did at the end of the chase. Three of the major race riots in this country over the past quarter century had been caused by what cops did at the end of a chase. When you get going at high speeds, especially through residential neighborhoods, that's scary, says Bob Martin, a former high-ranking LAPD officer, even if it is only 50 miles per hour. Your adrenaline and heart start pumping like crazy. It's almost like a runner's high. It's a very euphoric kind of thing. You lose perspective. You get wrapped up in the chase. There is that old saying, a dog in the hunt doesn't stop to scratch its fleas. If you've ever listened to a tape of an officer broadcasting in the midst of pursuit, you can hear it in the voice. They almost yell. For new officers, there's almost hysteria. I remember my first pursuit. I was only a couple of months out of the academy. It was through a residential neighborhood. A couple of times, we even went airborne. Finally, we captured him. I went back to the car to radio in and say we were okay, and I couldn't even pick up the radio. I was shaking so badly. Martin says that the King beating was precisely what one would expect when two parties, both with soaring heartbeats and predatory cardiovascular reactions, encounter each other after a chase. At a key point, Stacy Kuhn, one of the senior officers at the scene of the arrest, told the officers to back off, Martin says. But they ignored him. Why? Because they didn't hear him. They had shut down. Fife says that he recently gave a deposition in a case in Chicago in which police officers shot and killed a young man at the end of a chase. And unlike Rodney King, he wasn't resisting arrest. He was just sitting in his car. He was a football player from Northwestern. His name was Robert Russ. It happened the same night the cops there shot another kid, a girl, at the end of a vehicle pursuit, in a case that Johnny Cochran took and got over a $20 million settlement. The cops said he was driving erratically. He led them on a chase, but it wasn't even that high speed. They never got above 70 miles per hour. After a while, they ran him off the road. They spun his car out on the Dan Ryan Expressway. The instructions on vehicle stops like that are very detailed. You are not supposed to approach the car. You are supposed to ask the driver to get out. Well, two of the cops run up ahead and open the passenger side door. The other asshole was on the other side, yelling at Russ to open the door. But Russ just sat there. I don't know what was going through his head, but he didn't respond. So this cop smashes the left rear window of the car and fires a single shot, and it hits Russ in the hand and chest. The cop says that he said, "Show me your hands, show me your hands," and he's claiming now that Russ was trying to grab his gun. I don't know if that was the case. I have to accept the cop's claim. But it's beside the point. It's still an unjustified shooting because he shouldn't have been anywhere near the car, and he shouldn't have broken the window. Was this officer mind-reading? Not at all. Mind-reading allows us to adjust and update our perceptions of the intentions of others. In the scene in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where Martha is flirting with Nick while George lurks jealously in the background, our eyes bounce from Martha's eyes to George's, to Nick's, and around again, because we don't know what George is going to do. We keep gathering information on him because we want to find out. But Ami Klein's autistic patient looked at Nick's mouth, and then at his drink, and then at Martha's brooch. In his mind, he processed human beings and objects in the same way. He didn't see individuals with their own emotions and thoughts. He saw a collection of inanimate objects in the room and constructed a system to explain them, a system that he interpreted with such rigid and impoverished logic that when George fires his shotgun at Martha and an umbrella pops out, he laughed out loud. This, in a way, is what that officer on the Dan Ryan Expressway did as well. In the extreme excitement of the chase, he stopped reading Russ's mind. His vision and his thinking narrowed. He constructed a rigid system that said that a young black man in a car, running from the police, had to be a dangerous criminal, and all evidence to the contrary that would ordinarily have been factored into his thinking. The fact that Russ was just sitting in his car and that he had never gone above 70 miles per hour did not register at all. Arousal leaves us mind blind. Section 6. Running out of white space. Have you ever seen the videotape of the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan? It's the afternoon of March 30th, 1981. Reagan has just given a speech at the Washington Hilton Hotel and is walking out a side door toward his limousine. He waves to the crowd. Voices cry out, "President Reagan! President Reagan!" Then a young man named John Hinckley lunges forward with a .22 caliber pistol in his hand and fires 6 bullets at Reagan's entourage at point-blank range before being wrestled to the ground. One of the bullets hits Reagan's press secretary, James Brady, in the head. A second bullet hits a police officer, Thomas Delahanty, in the back. A third hits Secret Service agent Timothy McCarthy in the chest, and a fourth ricochets off the limousine and pierces Reagan's lung, missing his heart by inches. The puzzle of the Hinckley shooting, of course, is how he managed to get at Reagan so easily. Presidents are surrounded by bodyguards, and bodyguards are supposed to be on the lookout for people like John Hinckley, the kind of people who typically stand outside a hotel on a cold spring day waiting for a glimpse of their president, are well-wishers, and the job of the bodyguard is to scan the crowd and look for the person who doesn't fit, the one who doesn't wish well at all. Part of what bodyguards have to do is read faces. They have to mind read. So why didn't they read Hinckley's mind? The answer is obvious if you watch the video, and it's the second critical cause of mind blindness. There is no time. Gavin DeBecker, who runs a security firm in Los Angeles and is the author of the book The Gift of Fear, says that the central fact in protection is the amount of white space, which is what he calls the distance between the target and any potential assailant. The more white space there is, the more time the bodyguard has to react. And the more time the bodyguard has, the better his ability to read the mind of any potential assailant. But in the Hinckley shooting, there was no white space. Hinckley was in a knot of reporters who were standing within a few feet of the president. The Secret Service agents became aware of him only when he started firing. From the first instant when Reagan's bodyguard realized that an attack was underway, what is known in the security business as the moment of recognition, to the point when no further harm was done, was 1.8 seconds. The Reagan attack involves heroic reactions by several people, DeBecker says. Nonetheless, every round was still discharged by Hinckley. In other words, those reactions didn't make one single difference because he was too close. In the videotape, you see one bodyguard. He gets a machine gun out of his briefcase and stands there. Another has his gun out too. What are they going to shoot at? It's over. In those 1.8 seconds, all the bodyguards could do was fall back on their most primitive, automatic, and, in this case, useless impulse to draw their weapons. They had no chance at all to understand or anticipate what was happening. When you remove time, De Becker says, you are subject to the lowest quality intuitive reaction. We don't often think about the role of time in life or death situations, perhaps because Hollywood has distorted our sense of what happens in a violent encounter. In the movies, gun battles are drawn-out affairs, where one cop has time to whisper dramatically to his partner, and the villain has time to call out a challenge. And the gunfight builds slowly to a devastating conclusion. Just telling the story of a gun battle makes what happened seem to have taken much longer than it did. Listen to De Becker describe the attempted assassination a few years ago of the president of South Korea. The assassin stands up and he shoots himself in the leg. That's how it starts. He's nervous out of his mind. Then he shoots at the president and he misses. Instead, he hits the president's wife in the head, kills the wife. The bodyguard gets up and shoots back. He misses. He hits an 8-year-old boy. It was a screw-up on all sides. Everything went wrong. How long do you think that whole sequence took? 15 seconds? 20 seconds? No, 3.5 seconds. I think that we become temporarily autistic also in situations when we run out of time. The psychologist Keith Payne, for instance, once sat people down in front of a computer and primed them, just like John Barge did in the experiments described in Chapter 2, by flashing either a black face or a white face on a computer screen. Then Payne showed his subjects either a picture of a gun or a picture of a wrench. The image was on the screen for 200 milliseconds, and everyone was supposed to identify what he or she had just seen on the screen. It was an experiment inspired by the Diallo case. The results were what you might expect. If you are primed with a black face first, you'll identify the gun as a gun a little more quickly than if you were primed with a white face first. Then Payne redid his experiment, only this time he sped it up. Instead of letting people respond at their own pace, he forced them to make a decision within 500 milliseconds, half a second. Now, people began to make errors. They were quicker to call a gun when they saw a black face first. But when they saw a black face first, they were also quicker to call a wrench a gun. Under time pressure, they began to behave just as people do when they are highly aroused. They stopped relying on the actual evidence of their senses and fell back on a rigid and unyielding system, a stereotype. When we make a split-second decision, Payne says, we are really vulnerable to being guided by our stereotypes and prejudices, even ones we may not necessarily endorse or believe. Payne has tried all kinds of techniques to reduce this bias. To try and put them on their best behavior, he told his subjects that their performance would be scrutinized later by a classmate. It made them even more biased. He told some people precisely what the experiment was about and told them explicitly to avoid stereotypes based on race. It didn't matter. The only thing that made a difference, Payne found, was slowing the experiment down and forcing people to wait a beat before identifying the object on the screen. Our powers of thin slicing and snap judgments are extraordinary. But even the giant computer in our unconscious needs a moment to do its work. The art experts who judged the Getty Kuros needed to see the Kuros before they could tell whether it was a fake. If they had merely glimpsed the statue through a car window at 60 miles per hour, they could only have made a wild guess at its authenticity. For this very reason, many police departments have moved in recent years toward one-officer squad cars instead of two.